you. Do I reserve any time for rebuttal?
Reserve time to argue with myself.
And unfortunately, it gave you an extra 15 minutes to argue for the other side.
I hope I don't need to.
Okay, we'll get you here.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Charles Powers. I represent Christian Agostino von Hassel, the appellant. He's the husband in this matter. It's a divorce case coming out of Clark County. There's four issues that we've identified. I think there are a number of assignments of error, which is always a bad thing to do, raise a lot of issues. But it does boil down to four separate issues, and I'd like to address each of them. First one is classification of personal property. Most judges don't want to hear about personal property, but this was a classification issue. Of personal property, which was clearly separate property of Mr. von Hassel. The second one is across the board.
Let me just go ahead and ask you about that. It seems to me you correctly summarized kind of the party's testimony, but there was an email admitted into evidence where he disclaimed any ownership in the items as I understand it. If the trial judge, as fact finder, credited the email as him forfeiting any interest in these items personally, why was it error not to award it to him?
Judge, there's a distinction in what the evidence being presented was, and what Mr. von Hassel and what we're arguing about are items of his personal property that he owned prior to the marriage. The email that was brought into evidence was talking about property that had been inherited, and all the testimony was talking about items he had inherited from his family. There was discussion about whether or not it went into a trust or anything, but those were inherited items. Those are separate and distinct from this list of personal property, which both parties conceded was Mr. von Hassel's personal property prior to the party's marriage. So there's a distinction, and the email doesn't actually address that issue.
So the items you're talking about are not the items referenced in the email?
Correct, Judge. Correct. Judge, please. With respect to the personal property, I mean, it really does come down to both parties had conceded that these items were Mr. von Hassel's personal property. He owned it before they were married. There's no question it was his separate property. And just a blanket assertion or finding that any personal property in possession of each party is marital property is plainly wrong and cannot withstand withstand review and appeal. Judge, the second issue is somewhat related, talking about separate property, marital property, etc. Mr. von Hassel had a business called the Repton Group. And again, it was uncontested that this asset was owned, whose business was in existence prior to the party's marriage. And this was his separate property. It's a presumption, a rebuttable presumption. And no evidence was presented to show that there was a marital portion of this asset during the marriage. And to show a marital portion of the separate asset, they would have had to show that there were either personal contributions made, personal efforts made to the business during the marriage, or contribution of marital funds or anything of that nature. None of that was shown. And in fact, when they talked about this particular asset, they talked about what was it worth. This is the evidence presented by Ms. von Hassel. What was it worth when you got married?
On that issue, I could not find anywhere where the issue of classification of the Repton Group was addressed with the court. The court simply didn't value it. But where was there an objection to the classification of it being marital property?
Judge, the objection was to the fact of actually distributing it, and the only way to distribute it would be if it is marital property.
But for your record citation for where this assignment of error was preserved is pages 67 and 68 of the Joint Appendix, which the objection that's located there reads, defendant objects to the court allocating 100% of the marital debt to him to compensate plaintiff for her interest in the Repton Group, for which she presented no evidence of value, and as punishment to the defendant for management of marital resources that did not occur. So I think that goes to the next two assignments of error 34, which I think are completely well preserved by that statement. But the objection to it being found to be marital property, I don't see how you can possibly get there from that, recognizing that you're not responsible for that.
You hear this a lot, I'll say it again, that was not trial counsel. Judge, I'll just reiterate, by distributing it, he had to have classified it as marital property, which is an error.
He definitely classified it as marital property. He said he was classifying it as marital property.
The problem is that trial counsel, not you, did not object to that classification.
I'll move on to the next issue. With respect to the valuation and with respect to the actual distribution of it, and valuation is probably the most critical part. In order to
and maybe I can shortcut some of this for you. Assuming there was evidence to support that the Reptime Group had no value, or assuming that there was sufficient evidence to allow a prior fact to conclude that somehow she was entitled to $250,000 for her interest in the Reptime Group, it's impossible for both of those findings to be made simultaneously. She can't have a $250,000 interest in something that's worth zero.
Correct, Judge. I mean, and the judge said twice, this has no value whatsoever. So that's the error, and then going forth and then...
At least one of those things has to be wrong, if not both.
And I think both are probably wrong. But then the third part, where they're taking an asset that has no value and then actually distributing it. And this is where the judge, I think, made the error, is saying that to compensate Ms. Von Hassel for your interest in this business and all the mismanagement and waste of marital resources. Honestly, if he had said that, I don't know where we would be with that. But in his mind, obviously thinking that this Repton Group has some interest in it, that Ms. Von Hassel has an interest in it, and I'm going to make this sort of trade-off, that's where the error comes in. And I think it's sort of compounded it itself, even if it's marital property, just by valuing it, and then on top of it saying, I'm going to compensate.
He never distributed any interest in this group, in this company. I mean, this is an LLC, is it not?
It is.
So normally you would distribute that by distributing the stock of the LLC.
I think this was all titled in his name, so I don't think they could have even.
But that's how a corporation is different than something he owns. Its value is in stock.
Correct. So however this is held, titled, or otherwise, this is an asset. And we're dividing up the assets in the court, in its mind, obviously, gave Mr. Von Hassel this asset, said, you have this marital asset, which, again, whether or not it's marital or not, has no value, cannot be distributed. The third issue we're talking about is getting into spousal support, and it's always difficult to talk about factual findings, because if there's anything in the record to support it, this court must affirm that. What happened here was that this court arbitrarily looked at tax returns, looked at the party's tax returns, said, I'm going to determine what gross income is, cited 2108.2c, which is the child support definition of gross income, that's perfectly reasonable, which courts do that. But if you're going to accept or take on that responsibility to say, I'm going to look at 2108.2c's definition, you have to take the whole definition. And there, that statute specifically says, gross income shall be subject to deduction of reasonable business expenses. What the court then did was say, I'm going to disregard
the establishing the reasonable.
The burden is on Mr. Von Hassel to prove that. Mr. Von Hassel is the only one that presented evidence related to those business expenses.
Well, right, but just because he presented evidence doesn't mean the prior fact had to accept it.
And correct.
On the expense issue, it seems to me there were at least some items from which the prior fact could conclude that, and the prior fact clearly thought he was doing it, detected that they may have been declared twice.
What the judge did was looked at the just in total, and he called them hefty. He said there's hefty expenses, and you've already claimed them here, and I'm not going to let you claim them there. But no real discussion about what you mean by hefty.
But when you look at them, some of them look like they've been, and this is not an issue for us, it's an issue for an entirely different sovereign, but it appeared that for IRS purposes, the business of taking a deduction for something, and then he was taking a deduction for something, double counting. If the record supports such an inference that he was double counting, why isn't that sufficient to allow the prior fact to go, I don't believe any of his expenses because he clearly double counted?
I don't think the court can just arbitrarily discard.
That's not arbitrary. That's a person whose statement about expenses.
But when
they're called into question with evidentiary support to doubt it.
But when the court's ruling is just sort of an over across the board, these are hefty business expenses on the business return and additional hefty expenses on the personal return. This is Appendix 45, which is where the judge is making that exact comparison and just saying hefty business expenses here and additional hefty expenses there, focusing solely on there's a lot of business expenses. There's no real analysis. And when we're talking about weighing factors, and we brought this up and bring this up often, when you're weighing the statutory factors, there has to be some sort of substantive consideration given to the court's determination.
But if a prior fact could look at this record and determine that he was double counting at least some expenses, would that provide a basis not to be his expense claims?
I think if there was some specific, if they said on this return, and there was no evidence presented on these returns other than they were introduced into evidence, everyone agreed that these were their tax returns. But if someone had pointed out that here on this return is an advertising expense, and here on the personal return, oh, there's another advertising expense, and look, they're the same number, even close numbers. But there's no evidence presented related to that.
If we agree with your argument regarding the offset, the $350,000 offset, we have to remand this back for recalculation of equitable distribution, don't we?
Yes.
And if we do that, the court's going to have to then revisit spousal support in light of the fact that the wife made $350,000 more than she thought she was.
Yes, Judge. And that was one of the arguments I made here. But again,
so the spousal support could actually go up. Based on the fact that the corpus of this $350,000 is not there.
I hope it doesn't, but yes. It would give a trial, and they would have to reconsider and relook at this situation and argue these points, maybe with a little more detail on a remand. The final issue, Judge, we're bringing up is related to contempt finding, and I'd like to be able to come in here and say that the court couldn't find him in contempt, but I'm not that naive. The judge had the authority to determine if someone's in contempt.
He did, in fact, find him.
And he did find him in contempt. But what the problem is, he said, he didn't find him in civil contempt, and it was raised to him that Virginia Code 20-115 has a specific limit of incarceration of 12 months.
How do we know that he would ever serve in excess of 12 months? Why would that be moot at this point? I mean, I agree that the statute says what it does, and it may very well control, but until he is incarcerated for in excess of 12 months, how does he have any complaint?
I don't think we actually have to, because the judge's ruling is you're going to go sit in jail forever, and we don't have to wait forever. I'm not sure why or what the rationale would be to wait until you're actually being incarcerated and there for 12 months and a day, and then you can say, oh, I have a problem with this statutory request, this exclusion of the statute.
Along with the rightness problem that Judge Petty has identified, and perhaps I'm just too hopeful, is there any chance we haven't moved this problem? This was 10 months ago he was ordered to make this payment and report to jail. Any chance he's made it?
It's not on the record, but he has not made all of it. He's been making payments, Judge, but he has not made it. And there is this impending doom scenario. What's not in the record and where and why this is all tied together is the first item, those are assets of significant value, which the plan is get him, sell him, pay. But again, none of that's before us right now. He's facing an indeterminate sentence, and the judge specifically said, I don't buy the 2115 applies. Now, the appellee in her brief, I think, conceded the error. They have said, notwithstanding the trial court's position, it's understood that the 12 months is the maximum time to be served.
If in an opinion or an order we indicated that, notwithstanding the statement from the trial judge, 20-115 applies, does that solve your problem?
That solves that problem, Judge. It does solve that problem. But the other problem, the other part I've raised is, even though there is a limitation, there's nothing in this order or direction from the court other than to tell Ms. Von Hassel's attorney to let the court know whether or not payments have been made. Yeah. And he has to return to court. I'm sorry.
You view this as being onerous on him. It struck me that it was incredibly lenient. I think he was given a gift.
He was given an additional year.
He was found to be in contempt, could have gone to jail for a year right then, right there, and is told, you know, pay, which which includes a finding, an implicit finding at the time that he was capable of paying at the time.
Yes.
And he, whether he pays or not in the intervening year, all that is delaying when he goes to jail. It's not creating a new automatic, you go to jail if you don't do this. He's already supposed to go to jail. He just has a key.
What's different here is that he goes to jail. Regardless of what he's done, he has no ability to present to the court what has actually happened in the year leading up to the time he shows up on the doorstep.
You ask us to apply Neelam, and I have more than just a passing knowledge of Neelam, having written it. Neelam was a case where he had not yet been found in contempt. The payments that the judge was trying to coerce were payments that wouldn't accrue in the future. Here, he has failed to make the payments. The judge has found that failure to make them to be willful and found him contempt. So there's a significant difference. All this judge has done is said, I'm going to suspend imposition of that sentence and put you on probation. Term of your probation is that you make those payments in a timely manner.
It's civil contempt, which is contempt of the court. And it's an ongoing contempt. When you're being held in civil contempt, it's not one act, it's an ongoing
contempt. Well, actually, in this case it is, because he only found him in contempt for past due support. It's a known fixed number. It is, as of this day, you owe X amount of money. The minute you fix that, you don't. There's nothing new is being added to that total, as I understand the order.
I see I've run out of time.
You have run out of time. My colleagues have peppered you with questions if you'd like to add comments, if you'd like to answer any, then you're welcome to. I'll give you another minute.
I think it's not paying is part of the ongoing contempt, and not having the ability to then say at the last minute, here's what I have done, Judge.